I'm going to switch this over here. Can you hear me? Great. Shabbat shalom. I am dedicating this devar to my friend Eliana Temkin, because without her, I would not be up here today. Eliana and I used to work together at the JCC a long time ago. And one day she said she was going to a study session. And I said, why on earth are you doing that? And Eliana, who is quite sassy, said, why on earth aren't you? And I gave that question some thought, and I ended up going up with her, and that was my first ever Torah study. Because if one person is brave enough to ask a question, and another person is brave enough to consider it, this is how change comes into the world. So this one's for you, babe. Mwah. This is Parsha Vayiki. He lived. Who lived? Jacob. Last Shabbat, in the Parsha, Jacob blessed all his children in what may be the origin of the term mixed blessing. Our Parsha opens with the final of these, and it's the one for Benjamin. Benjamin, says his father, quote, is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he consumes the foe, and in the evening he divides the spoil. Our tradition holds that these statements of Jacob's are as much a prophecy as a blessing. And aren't all blessings a kind of prophecy in that they seek to order the future? Having provided for his children fodder for therapy sessions for years to come, Jacob gives instructions about his burial and he dies. Or he maybe dies. The text is not explicit. He is embalmed, though Jews aren't usually embalmed, and there's mourning among the Egyptians. Remember, Joseph, his son, is an Egyptian. He has to go to Pharaoh to ask for permission to leave and bury his father. Permission is granted, and a very large troop of Egyptian court officials, tribal members, children, wives, chariots, flocks, they all go and bury Jacob in the cave at Machpelah. When Joseph returns, his brothers are worried about whether or not he still holds a grudge against them. They give a forged statement to the effect that it was Jacob's dying wish that they would be forgiven and say, in any case, we are prepared to be your slaves. And Joseph responds by saying, what am I, God? Because there's always been a little bit of the Jewish mother in Joseph. He assures them that all is forgiven, all was for the best, and then he dies. And this is the final parsha in Genesis. As some of you know, my practice is to accept the devar without looking at the subject first, since the idea is not to seek out a text that relates to me, but to find out how I may learn from the text. We sometimes have a very narrow view of the so-called wrestling with a Jewish text, as if that concept only applies when we disagree with it. But the point of a wrestling match is to pin something down. When Jacob wrestles the angel, his prize, after all, is a name. We can also wrestle with a text we agree with, one we find anachronistic, impossible, or dull. In this case, I had a built-in aversion to the subject matter because I am just not that great with death. I mean, I understand they have to wrap up these lives and move on, but here in the dead of winter, with already a bleak predisposition to seeing the end of things, the dying of the secular year, the empty trees, the narrow days, I yearned for something, you know, lively. And at the same time, that is not the Torah portion. The plain meaning is death, and this ends a book. Ends a book, not the book. Here's an illustration of my situation. At 90, my father fell, and he ended up in hospice, and it was one of the few times in my life I ever saw him angry, because he was the kindest of men. Later, he apologized profusely, but at the time, he was so furious that he just lay there stiffly, refusing to talk to anyone. He was mad at himself for falling. All of us took shifts to be with him in that place, which was on the east side, and we live on the west side, and it was kind of a long haul, so I would turn on the radio when I was driving back and forth. Now, you would think, in this time of turmoil and pain, that I'd go straight to the classical station, which I ordinarily preferred, for something comforting and classical. But it turned out that the only thing I was able to tolerate was the most outrageous, X-rated, scatological, and raucous hip-hop that I could find. Killer Mike and Nas, Lil Wayne, Foxy Brown, at full volume. And at one point, I was so discombobulated, I'd run a stop sign, and a cop pulled me over. And I rolled down the window, and with a stricken expression, I said, "I'm so sorry. It's because my father is ill, and I'm just so upset." And behind me the whole time, there's Chance the Rapper going, "We're all gonna bleep the bleep, and then bleep, bleep, the bleep. You bleep." And that cop's face held a question that I often see in the mirror. What is wrong with you? I mean, really, what was wrong with me? And it was only much later, after he died, that I realized that songs about sex and power and boasting and diss tracks made me feel closer to my father, who was so full of vitality, and such a life-loving and life-affirming guy. And that was what called him forth to me. It was not a choir intoning, "Nearer, my God, to thee," but Big Sean singing, well, I don't have enough beeps to quote Big Sean. But what I mean to say is that even when death was right there in front of me, I took life. It was a dirty life, but I took it nevertheless. So perhaps I am not prepared to face death, but Jacob is. He already has his burial plot bought and paid for. In fact, this parsha is kind of a masterclass on the many levels in the Jewish way of death. And this is not only because we derive rituals from it, such as allotting 7 days for sitting Shiva, but because in a very short and relatively few words, it has highly impressive insights into our experience of dying and loss. First of all, there's this description that encompasses our naive hope that it won't happen at all. There's no definitive sentence that Jacob died, which is maybe also like a secret we hold, however irrational, that everyone will live forever. And if we can't bring that about, how great would it be to bless everyone before the end and to prove that you are right about some things, to have your affairs ordered, the details of your interment arranged. Jacob's death is neither sudden nor violent. He's given the space to have a departure that's filled with meaning. It's the nature of the Torah to present us with heroes that often represent our best possible outcomes, something to aspire to, a blessing that's a blueprint. When we think about the two great mysteries that form the lodestar of our existence, which is why we are born and how we will die, we see that an honor bestowed on the heroes of the Bible, I'm not sure about the matriarchs, might have to think about that for another devar, the heroes of the Bible are given the comfort of composing themselves before death. Despite some pushback I might get from lovers of elephants, chimpanzees, and magpies, humans are the primary animals who bury their dead. And they are definitely the only ones who build great cathedrals and monuments, set aside vast tracts of perfectly arable land to do so. So we could say one of the things that makes us human is that we bury our dead. Cave burial in the ancient world was common. In the Christian Bible, Mary wonders if she's going to be able to move the rock away from Jesus' tomb because he's not in a coffin, as some paintings would have it, but he's in a cave. Bodies were laid out on sort of shelves in a communal rock-like structure or a natural cave. Burial in coffins comes later. The Egyptians built some of the most elaborate tombs visible today, and that was because the afterlife was fundamental to that culture. They embalmed and they mummified in the belief that there was going to be a reunification of the soul and the body. And evidently, souls were easily confused and needed the ancient equivalent of really good facial recognition software to find their bodies. And we know this, by the way, because disciplines that study the past, archaeologists, anthropologists, historians, learn most of what they know via burial sites and garbage dumps. All the way back to the most presence of men, what we know best about ourselves is what we throw away and what we preserve. There is more here than can be covered in a brief devar, but I'll point out one more interesting aspect of death that appears here in our signature Jewish text. It's a psychological reality of grief expressed by that exchange between Joseph and his brothers. Joseph's brothers are rightfully fearful because when we are in pain, because we have suffered loss, We want somewhere to shift the blame. We seek a culprit for our misfortune. Death throws everything off kilter. It's very tricky. A lot of bad things can happen in the spaces between when we are here and when we are gone. Cycles of vengeance, for example, can be ignited by our desire to hold someone responsible for our loss. And those vengeance cycles are very difficult to end. Maybe that's part of the sequestering of the 7 days. It's not just for the body and the soul of the deceased, but because we, the living, are also in a state of transition. And of course, where there's blame, there's also the possibility of forgiveness, which returns us to the very beginning we have filtered through to our last image. Straight away, the commentators want to know, why is Benjamin named to be wolfish? It is, after all, the tribe of Benjamin along with Judah who are going to become the Jewish people. That's it. Everyone else is lost. So what? Are we wolves? Devourers? Consumers? Well, yeah, probably. Dividers of spoil? Rashi tackles this because nothing scares Rashi and uses as his proof text a truly horrible story from Judges and a sweet reference to altars in the Talmud. Now, I'm going to paraphrase an hour-long podcast I listened to by Rabbi Moshe New of the Montreal Torah Center, who parses not the verse of the Parsha, that would take like 6 days, but this single assertion of Rashi's. He says, to paraphrase, that by seizing upon the idea of the ravenous and the devouring and looking at it through that problematic proof text about chopping up people, we come to understand that almost any act can be forgiven if the repentance is sincere enough. Even more importantly, return and repentance are a route that becomes open to us as we are leaving Egypt. The change that is coming for us is not a slow evolution, but a radical transformation from one state of being to another. And this change is best represented by something in the nature of snatching and devouring and consuming. The difference between the fading of Joseph and the rise of Benjamin, who are both righteous men, is that Joseph is righteous because he is transcendent and above the world, but Benjamin is engaged in the world. It is harsh and fast and extreme. He cites the words of Shmuel in the Talmud. I'm not quite sure how. I mean, an hour is a long time to listen to a brilliant rabbi gulping bottled water and turning down questions. But here's what the Talmud has to say. This world is like a wedding feast. You have to snatch and eat and snatch and drink because wedding feasts do not last forever, only a few hours. So make the most of it, not for yourself, but that you seize every mitzvah and every chance to create change in the world. We see this slogan around, the future is waiting. I have news for the slogan. The future is not waiting. The future is already launched. I prefer the Chinese version, which says, the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago, and the second best time is now. I think of this all now, specifically this time of year, as we navigate the influence of the dominant culture in which we are a part. We hum their carols while shopping. We're glad their holiday lights are up when it's dark and dreary, and we nibble their cookies at our office parties. But I want to offer you something a little different from all that, drawn from these ancient tombs and burial sites that inform our death-ridden readings this morning. It's only a symbol, but then symbols are never only. For example, the Egyptian Ankh was a symbol of life. They are, after all, our Middle Eastern brothers and sisters. But it's not this life that is meant. They embalm their people and place them in the Great Pyramids to underscore not this life, but the afterlife. And then there's the symbol we see a lot of now, the cross. I have nothing against a cross, but I want to say about it, no matter how cute or festooned with flowers or with adorable angels clinging to it, that cross is a crucifix, and a crucifix is emblematic of a status quite opposite of our own. The symbol we associate most with Jews is the Mogen David, that six-pointed star that says Jew to our modern eyes. And of course, we all have a lot of respect for it, especially its reminder of something that was pinned to the murdered millions. But there's a much more ancient symbol that represents us and has for millennia. And when they unearthed the oldest synagogues or uncover a burial cave and wonder who were these inhabitants? Were they Israelites? They are not looking for the Mogen David, but for a candelabra. Those ancient menorahs far predate that star. And as we head into the great definitive saga of us Jews, who have shown strength in their mighty caravan on the way to the burial of one of their own, perhaps occasioning some murmurs that they have become too numerous. And we hear the echo of Joseph's assertion to his brothers that they are not, in fact, slaves. I hope we also see that we are not a cross and we are not an ankh. Our sign is the candle, necessary for cooking, heat, and light, visible to each other and to others. Very useful, very beautiful, very brief. Shabbat Shalom.